Judge Andrew Beecroft retires tomorrow as Commissioner for Children after 5 years in the job. He says he's given everything too. And he says while some progress has been made, far too many tamariki experience abuse, neglect, poverty and poor health and education outcomes. Judge Beecroft has long campaigned for an end to Oranga Tamariki youth justice facilities, which he says cause more harm than good. And he strongly advocated for a self-contained, standalone youth court for everyone under 18, a rise in the minimum age of criminal responsibility from the current age of 10, and far more Baia Māori, for Māori initiatives. Andrew, tēnā koe, welcome to 9 to Noon.
Tēnā koe, ata Māori.
Can we begin, please, with poverty, which, despite government efforts and government targets, you say still puts New Zealand on an international roll of shame. What progress has been made and what hasn't?
Oh, I think things have happened that we wouldn't have even dreamed of 5 years ago. We've got child poverty reduction legislation. We've got targets to halve child poverty in 10 years. We've got a child and youth wellbeing strategy. We've had benefits now indexed to wage increases. We've got 200,000 kids getting free school lunches. Benefits have increased. I mean, let's acknowledge that there has been progress, but I guess it's not been the sort of transformational progress that we dreamed about. I mean, I think we still need a Michael Joseph Savage moment, number two. If we wanted to really prioritise children, we will need to increase family tax credit and the core benefits to make up from the 1991 benefit slashes. So I guess it's holding two things in tension. We've done some good work. I applaud what's been done, cross-party often, but there's so much more to do, and that's the tension.
The working group recommendations, which talked about a core benefit increase of up to 40%, when you take into account the various steps and various budgets, has that been met or is it anywhere near being met?
Yeah, it has been, but bear in mind the Welfare Expert Advisory Group said the key delivery mechanism was an increase in the family tax credit. That's the one that still hasn't happened because that would target children. And I think we would say in the 90s, we targeted the elderly and that was great. New Zealand is perhaps the best place in the world to be over 65. So we made that choice. But we didn't prioritise children at the same time. We made the choice not to. And my concern has always been that there's something mangled in our economic settings that we do so well for one group, the over 65s, but so badly relatively for the under 18s. That's why I say we belong on an international roll of shame, because we could fix it if we wanted to. But yes, it is going to be increase in money benefits and I guess ensuring income equality. That's the real key.
Has there been an obsession by governments with endeavouring to keep the numbers on benefits low, and parallel to that, a belief that if benefit levels get lifted too much, they become something of a choice? Has there been an obsession with that?
To a degree, I think that's right. Everything that we read now in the science is that the first 1,000 days of a child's life is crucial. There's something a bit warped, I think, in our policy settings where we incentivize return to work when we know that the work of putting determined emotional investment into an early child's life is critical. And I think we underplayed that importance. And I think we should, as a country, be saying nothing's more important than valuing those first 1,000 days. And that's where our tax incentives should really lie.
Since the 1990s, though, and across governments, and perhaps because of high unemployment, high overall benefit rates in the 1990s, there has been a persistent focus on this, including for a long time ensuring there was a gap using the in-work credit between household income on a benefit and household income from work. Again, is there an arguable justification from that when you look at it from a government policy point of view? Or has it become something of an obsession with 125,000 kids in material poverty, a considerable percentage of them from benefit families? Has that been the price?
It absolutely has been the price. And you know, in 1991, before the benefits were slashed, about 12% of those on benefits qualified as being in income-related poverty, and about 8% of those who were working. Now, that working figure has stayed about the same in the last 30 years, but those on benefits who qualify to be income poor has risen from about 12% to nearly 78%. So benefits no longer provide the safety net. And whatever the obsession, as you call it, from government has been, the cold, hard reality is we don't provide the adequate security that we used to. And that's been the big change. And it happened really overnight in 1991. We never made up the difference. Benefit increases were never linked to wage increases. Wages doubled, the gross domestic product quadrupled, unemployment dropped considerably, but we did not ensure that children and families doing it tough were looked after. And we're paying the price now. The burden was disproportionately, I guess, shouldered by children. And I can't stress enough how unfair I think that is. We could have a decent life for all New Zealand children if we wanted to. At the moment, our choice has been not to do that.
The philosophy has been that actually the so-called benefit trap, or being on benefits for a long time, was core to the poverty trap. Can you comment on that argument and its merits, and then perhaps on the, even if it has merits, what the reality is for children?
Yeah, I understand the argument. And of course, in the wider scheme of things, everybody knows that families with a member working provides huge benefits. And that's the right thing to be aiming at. But my point is the current jigging of the system penalises, I think now deliberately penalises, children and families where they either can't get work, or there are disability issues, or work is simply unavailable. Now, I think we've got to do better. When Michael Joseph Savage formulated the welfare state, he called it applied Christianity. The opposition called it applied lunacy. I think there is some lunacy afoot now. It is lunacy the way our economic settings are positioned. And we really need some pretty bold and courageous steps. Now, I applaud what's been done, but small incremental changes won't cut it. We do need some bold, committed, courageous change. And that, I think, is the challenge for every government in New Zealand in the next 10 years.
You mentioned the differential between the growth in poverty among benefit households and families and those in work. But if we don't have a growth now in the percentage of working poor, those in material hardship, are we about to discover that we're getting one?
Absolutely, we are. And I don't want to underestimate the need for supporting families that are in work and are really struggling too. That's why the Welfare Expert Advisory Group Family Tax Credit recommendation is so crucial, because that'll target children primarily, whether in work or not, families.
How much needs to be spent? Because this is another argument, and the late Sir Michael Cullen mentioned it in his memoir, published not long before he died, that New Zealanders are averse to paying relatively high taxes. And when you look to some of the nations that have very, very comprehensive supports, long periods of parental leave, for example, that's state-funded, and other family supports, they have significantly higher tax rates than we have. Again, has it become a received wisdom across both political major parties that comparatively lower tax rates is better for the economy and better for society, one would presume their philosophy to be? And again, is that a barrier to the sort of increases you're talking about?
Yes, yes, and yes is the short answer. It has become an article of faith that there are no new taxes. The reality is the cost of what we're talking about to recover what we lost in 1991 is going to be up to $2 billion a year. We abandoned that commitment in 91. Wages grew quickly, but benefits didn't keep pace. To make up the difference now, it is going to be about $2 billion. I mean, a capital gains tax off the table. I think the reality is that many of us, if we knew extra taxes were going to children and struggling families to ensure more of an equal society, we'd happily do that. So many people tell me that up and down the country, but it seems all governments in New Zealand have taken off the table increased taxes. Not that I'm saying money cures everything, but I'll tell you, it is a very good start. And if you don't have it, it's crucial. I think looking at in-kind benefits like free school lunches for 200,000 kids, that's another way of helping. Free medical care for every child up to the age of 18. That's a different way of doing it. So I think it's a combination of a bigger tax spend, and that probably inevitably means increased taxes to a degree, combined with in-kind support of the sort I've just talked about. But yep, I think you hit the nail on the head. We're not going to increase taxes, and it's going to therefore mean a big challenge for any government. And I don't see any way out of it unless we do increase taxes like many other Western world countries do.
The improvements that have been seen, and I just got them across the various measures of child poverty that the government introduced and is using, I was surprised to see that there have been measures across even the likes of material hardship and severe material hardship, because for a time there wasn't. Again, these figures are already out of date. They're June 2020. When you factor the impact of the pandemic and the impact of what has happened to housing poverty, what are your hopes for the trajectory of those child poverty statistics?
Oh, you're right. The material hardship figure is a door knock, a literal door knock, surveying 20,000 families, and it's now 18 months to 2 years out of date. It did show a decline from about 140,000 to 125,000, but that's still Eden Park, as it were, filled twice over by children, the spectator size, 125,000. That ought to stop us in our tracks. The reality is COVID, we know, is going to make it worse for that 125,000. The burden has disproportionately fallen on their shoulders. I mean, my hope is that COVID is not an excuse to do less, but it's a reason to do more. And I hope the government can redouble its efforts to really help that struggling group. And, you know, it's worse than just that bare statistic, because in the Māori population, about a quarter of children, or one-fifth of children, 20%, qualify as being in material hardship. For Pacifica, it's 25%, whereas for European, it's 7 to 8%. So there is wired into that material hardship figure some gross and, I think, pretty shocking disparities between Māori, Pacifica, disabled, and European. And I don't see how we can tolerate that.
A big focus of your time has been Oranga Tamariki. It's been riven with controversy over decades, frankly, but in its previous iterations as well, and it's under great pressure. It's currently again without a chief executive, but the youth justice facilities that you'd been so outspoken against are finally to close, one of the last decisions of the outgoing acting chief executive, Wira Gardner. Do you welcome that, and is that a permanent closure or a temporary closure? Is that permanent?
As I understand it, there's a decided commitment to abolish all the big, large-scale concrete institutions. They are so last century. I mean, they have their origins in the philanthropy of the 1800s, the poorhouses and the orphanages. But we know that separating our most troubled young people from the most violent and traumatic backgrounds and aggregating them together under one roof is not a recipe for enduring rehabilitation, the opposite, in fact. And we know that abuse flourishes. So yes, as I understand it, and hallelujah for this, there is a commitment to phase them out, abolish them, and replace them by smaller scale, expert, therapeutic, family type homes throughout the country. That's the right way to go. And I welcome that. As for Oranga Tamariki generally, I think in the care and protection space, it had been off course for about 30 years. And all that I have read recently, all the public concern indicates that there is an awareness that transformational change is required. And I'm optimistic it's going to happen.
Wasn't there an opportunity for it to happen in the recent review and for the government to take a bolder step than it did? When you talk about a transfer of power to Māori, have you seen anything so far along those lines?
There have been one or two real glimmers of hope. For instance, in Kaikoura, Ngāpuhi Social Services have developed and are delivering a fantastic secure remand service one-on-one using well-trained homes and caregivers in the north with good mentors in place. And those young boys don't need to go to big institutions. They're integrated into the community. They're kept safe and the community is kept safe. That's the sort of thing that I'm talking about. And yes, I wish the government had been more explicit about a total transformation, but I think there's enough in what the Waitangi Tribunal report said for certain and the Ministerial Advisory Group's report, there's enough there to show there is a clear direction of travel towards what I would call revolution by devolution, devolving power and resources. And I do think that is the way to go in the 21st century. If we don't grab that moment now, I think we're lost in terms of the state care system.
What of the statutory powers that the state has given itself with respect to children? And how much can this be part of such a devolution when they are such sweeping powers?
Yeah, I think however it's resolved, the powers have to shrink. But I think all of us would agree that the state can't contract out its underlying responsibility to ensure in crisis situations children are kept safe. So I think the state will always legitimately be involved in that. And there probably will always, this side of heaven, need to be removals. But if Māori are involved in partnership, I tell you, it would look a whole lot different, the process, than it has done for the last 30 years. And just taking that Hastings case as one example, as soon as iwi were involved, as soon as there was a reaching out to say, can we do this in partnership, everything changed. And everything would change up and down the country. And as iwi and Māori organisations are more involved, I'm really, really confident that the landscape would shift in a transformative way, particularly in terms of earlier intervention and prevention. And I think that's where, I mean, if we're dreaming, many of the government social workers could be incorporated into local community social work services, iwi Māori organisations. We know from the way we've talked to whānau and children themselves, by Māori for Māori approaches work better. They work better in education. So, I don't think we're talking about anything that's sort of off the planet. I mean, this is, I think, a basic application of what the treaty means, and it works.
You came to this role from the youth court. Forgive me if there was a step in between, but you were best known to the public prior to this for your work in the youth court and your innovation in the youth court. Now that you turn your focus from the immediate role, what do you say about where we are at in our, treatment and management of young offenders and a system that, if possible, redirects their futures from prison?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I took this role was to be able to say and do in public what I couldn't constitutionally say as principal youth court judge. So I start by saying we have a world-leading youth justice system, little understood in New Zealand, but many overseas are envious. But there's more things we could do to improve our system. I mean, it's terrific that we now have most 17-year-olds in the youth justice system. It works better for those 17-year-olds than the adult system always will. I'd like to get the rest, a small group of 17-year-olds who aren't there, in. My dream would be a totally self-contained youth court where every single offence is dealt with in that court, including murder and manslaughter, with properly warranted youth court judges. That youth-specific approach involving wraparound services, I think, offers much more hope of directing a young person from a life of crime. And I think reserving murder and manslaughter to the High Court, where there's mandatory life imprisonment for 12 and 13-year-olds who may be only peripherally involved, I think, is the wrong approach. And we should go the whole way, complete the circle, and fully reform the system so that the youth court's empowered to deal with every young person who offends. That, I think, will provide hope for our country. And while we're at it, our minimum age of criminal responsibility at 10 is just unarguably and immorally too low. 10 is just inappropriate. United Nations have made that crystal clear. Think of a 10-year-old we know. Could they stand in a dock taking full responsibility for their own offending? It should be at least 12, and I would love it to be 14, because that's the internationally recommended level.
Again, if we look at the 1990s, that was a time when there was public outrage at a number of high-profile and, you know, deeply disturbing crimes that a lot of New Zealanders identified with. Have we moved on, not with abhorrence when terrible things are done to people that are wrong, but with understanding more about the lives of many young offenders? Let's focus on young offenders, and ways in which interventions may at least help mitigate their futures. Do we understand more? And is there more tolerance in New Zealand today than there was in the 1990s for alternative means of working with young offenders?
I think there is, and I think that's hugely encouraging. And I think we now know that young people who commit serious offences are invariably from the most traumatic and dislocated and marginalised and often violent backgrounds. They are well known to the care and protection arm of Oranga Tamariki. They've been lost to education. I mean, these aren't my kids and yours. These are children who are deeply, deeply damaged by their environment, and they need significant help. And often there are neurodevelopmental disorders, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, autism, that we just simply do not know enough about. So in short, yes, I sense a sea change, and I sense that the community says, while we have young people who we can work with, we've got a huge opportunity to turn them away from a life of crime. And I'm encouraged by that.
And having sat in those courts settings and having got on the phone sometimes to offenders to make sure they turn up the next day, can you talk about what's possible and what isn't? If a starting point for our society is, if you are going to go out and harm people and you cannot be diverted from that, then society has a right to be protected from your behaviour. If we take that perhaps as a foundation, but then look at what you have seen achieved through serious intervention and recognition of the issues a young person has brought to that courtroom, can you say hand on heart that change and the safety of the public can be accommodated in many cases with the right intervention?
Absolutely, yes, and my hand is on my heart. There are very, very few young people who I meet as Children's Commissioner or in my previous role who I don't think, with good, concentrated assistance and support and interventions for them and their wider family, can't be turned around. That's, I think, the exciting optimism. We need to know that. But yes, we need to have secure facilities, and they'll be smaller scale, and sometimes to ensure protection from or protection to themselves and to others, will need to ensure they're kept secure. But in the long run, the good news is, with good interventions, invariably, but not always, young people can be turned around. And that, I think, is something we have to hold on to as a community. I mean, it's really our last best shot at that age group, and we've got to give it all we're worth. That's why a youth-specific, coordinated, targeted approach that was dealt with all young people, I think that's what offers real hope. Treating them as junior adults isn't going to benefit either the community or the young people themselves. You almost guarantee they'll live a life of marginalisation.
Last day as Children's Commissioner tomorrow. I hope you'll have a weekend off. But what is in your sights next? Or is a good break the first thing?
Yeah, it's actually 11:59 Sunday night. I can say this has been one of the genuine honours of my life, this role. When I started, I had no idea of the privilege of the sense of responsibility and the opportunity. And I've met children up and down the country who never cease to encourage me and inspire me. What's next? A short break. I'm a judge and have been for some time. So I hope through my experience here, I'll be a better judge. I hope I'll take away the lessons. So when I get back into the judicial system, I hope I'll never forget what children and young people have been telling me. And I hope that I can add value in a new and different way, but that'll be for the future. But I have no absolute specific plans other than my wife has said, if you don't use your leave, not only will you lose it, you might lose me too. So first step is just to spend some time together.
Best that you follow that then. Who does determine a judge's future in many ways? I mean, this is just curiosity now. Is this a decision made by the various heads of bench? Do you have some say in it?
Correct. No, it's a matter for heads of bench, for the Chief Justice and the Attorney General. And they will probably want me to keep my head down and shut up for a while, which is what judges are meant to do, but it'll be a time to reflect. And yes, and my wife's been terrifically encouraging. It's really been a two-person job, me and her. She's a lawyer herself and couldn't have done it without her. So yeah, as to the future, that'll be for the judicial mechanisms to kick into place and make those decisions.
Thank you, Judge Beecroft. Judge Andrew Beecroft retires as Commissioner for Children. I was going to say tomorrow, but it sounds like he's on call till Sunday night.